For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Manuela Tanyao no ia imbaldi and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and it is a privilege to be spending this time with you this morning. Coming up on the show today, PNG conjoined twin babies are still in need of surgery, but where? Controversy over two cabinet ministers resigning within the space of 3 weeks in Fiji. Meanwhile, unsafe transport conditions for hospitality workers in Fiji. And there is excitement brewing as Tor Samoa prep for the finals clash against the Kiwis this weekend. All that and more here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We begin in Papua New Guinea, where doctors at the biggest hospital say the chances of survival for conjoined twin baby boys are slim, and surgery to separate them is not an immediate priority. Tom and Sawong were born on October 7 at a small rural hospital, joined at the abdomen, and were airlifted to the country's capital for further care. Doctors at the Port Moresby General Hospital initially explored the possibility of transferring the twins to Sydney for specialist care. But the hospital's Director of Medical Services, Konisobi, says they're now recommending against that. Jujun Ra, the pilot who flew the twins to Port Moresby, has been helping the family explore options to go overseas for further medical treatment, including in Germany. Dr. Sobi says the hospital can provide medical records to other hospitals, but not a referral for surgery, as the boys are too fragile for arduous overseas travel.
Yeah, well, the doctors from Germany have not reached out to us. I'm sure they have our contacts, but we have not received any direct request from the hospital in Germany. And again, we are not driving that referral, but, you know, obviously, Captain Jagan Ru, as you have mentioned, is going out of his way to make this, and we will provide reports. We've made a mention to him that we will provide reports, but not necessarily recommending a referral, knowing that it's quite, you know, Germany is halfway around the world, it's a huge undertaking, huge risk. So we stand to support providing a medical report and a medical imaging. As you know, from our discussions and collaborations, consultations with the Sydney Children's Team, one of the things that was emphasized is that the immediate surgery is not the priority from those who have undertaken this. So it means that it'll be, you know, a few more months, weeks, or even months to try and, as you know, the babies are quite small. The total weight of both twins together is less than 3 kilograms. So they are small. They need to be fed. You know, they need to be provided avenue for them to grow before they can actually intervene surgically. So again, whilst we are keeping them, we feel that both for the parents and for babies, best we can do is to feed them, give them the nutrition and mitigate infection and other complications. And that's what we're doing for the babies at the moment. We have done multiple consultations, medical consultations amongst ourselves. We have anesthetist, intensive care team in Pongjin, surgeons, pediatric surgeons. And since the arrival of the twins, we have had a number of consultations with our counterparts in Australia, specialist teams in surgery. And through all of that discussions, we have reached a decision. The underlying thing is that both twins present with significant congenital anomalies. And we feel that even with you know, care and treatment in highly specialized units, the chances of survival are very, very slim. In fact, the prognosis is extremely guarded. And based on that, we feel that both twins will remain with us, and we will continue to provide care as long as possible. So that is basically our stand. We have come across this decision, come about to this decision, based on numerous consultations that we have, not only in Port Moresby, but also our colleagues in Australia in this area of specialised care. As you know, conjoined twins is not something that happens often, and for many of us, this is our first time we're experiencing such a very difficult scenario. And we have had discussions with the family and the family members. Of course, it's very difficult if you put yourself in those circumstances for families to come to understand and come to grip with this scenario. So that is where we are in terms of our stand. I know there have been concerns about getting babies to Australia. From the medical point of view, that's the stand that we have. Just to clarify a bit more, one of the twins, I mean, both twins have quite significant congenital malformations. One of the twins has a congenital heart defect. The same twin also has only one kidney, and we believe that same twin has got healed or malformed lungs. And so perhaps one of the twins is doing a lot of the work in terms of the supplying of oxygen and even for the heart for the other one. So really it's a precarious condition for both. One of them, I mean, they both depend on each other, really. Where they go on from here, it's anyone's guess, in our view, as long as we provide support to them in terms of feeding them, and that's one of our priorities, and guarding against infection.
And that's Dr. Connie Sobey, Director for Medical Services at Port Moresby General Hospital.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Solomon Islands, where a young man is still receiving treatment after a World War II bomb caused a large explosion in the capital Honiara last Thursday. Unexploded ordnances, UXO, left behind by Allied and Japanese forces, remains scattered around the Solomon Islands and other Pacific nations. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele told media yesterday, as the Pacific Island Forum chair, it's spearheading a regional program on UXOs.
This is a huge, threat in our country. It's unfortunate that we have lost lives over the years, including the recent incident where somebody was injured, I believe. But it's a huge challenge, a huge obstacle to the lives of our people, a huge obstacle to our development efforts in the country. The Ministry of Police continues to attach priority to this. Work with the HALO Foundation continues in terms of UXOs, as well as with our other partners. And it's also at the regional level, part of the outcomes of the 54th Forum Communique. We would like to sensitize this threat at the regional level, because it's not only Solomon Islands, there are also other countries in the region that have these World War II legacies in terms of UXOs. So we will be initiating or spearheading a regional program on UXOs as well. And we would like to pursue this during our term now as chair of the forum.
And that's Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele speaking there to journalists in a press conference in Honiara.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Fiji, where two cabinet ministers have resigned within the space of 3 weeks. The now former Minister of Finance, Biman Prasad, and Minister of External Trade, Manoa Kamikamida, are facing corruption charges from the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption. The resignations have spurred speculations of a fractured government, but it's also intensified public scrutiny over FICAC, which has been at the centre of controversy over the last year. John Frankel, Professor of Political Science at Victoria University in New Zealand, joins me now. With that, I say yandere, Mr. Frankel. Thanks for joining us.
Yandere Vinaka.
Thank you. Well, look, let's get straight into it. I mean, we have these two former Deputy Prime Ministers, right? Kamikamida and Prasad, stepping down because of corruption charges. I must say there are concerns that this may be a sign of fracture in the coalition. What's your take?
Well, coalitions regularly break down as countries head into elections worldwide, and we're only a year out from the next election. And I think some in the Prime Minister, Sidibe Rambuka's party, the People's Alliance, think that they could win on their own without the small party, the National Federation Party, that's led by Biman Prasad, who's one of these deputies. Prime Ministers who stepped down. These two deputy prime ministers come from different parties. Biman Prasad is leader of the National Federation Party, was once a largely Fiji Indian backed party, but Manoa Kamikamida comes from the Prime Minister's own party. Indeed, he's one of the founder members of that party. And I think there are tensions within the People's Alliance Party that are centered around this Commission of Inquiry report and other factors. Indeed, one of the founder members of the People's Alliance Party, Naula Mataitini, a few months ago called on Rambuka to step down as leader. So there are tensions within the People's Alliance Party, and neither the National Federation Party nor the People's Alliance Party have committed to continuing the coalition into the next general election. And then, of course, there's a third party, SODELPA, and they haven't committed either to their coalition partners next time around.
Well, if we look at the controversies that are concerning, you know, FICAC itself, in particular, we know the dismissal of Barbara Malimali and the Commission of Inquiry. Does it actually then undermine public trust of this organisation?
Yeah. Well, I think the charges are damaging, certainly for the two leaders. But my reading, the Commission of Inquiry report, the charges being brought against both Manoa Kamikamida and Biman Prasad are extremely frivolous and very small claims. They're certainly not grand corruption or anything like that about whether Biman mentioned a directorship on a form that he wasn't required to complete. And Manoa's charge is about whether he was seeking to influence the Judicial Services Commission appointment of Barbara Malimali. But they're very thin. I mean, it's for the courts to decide, but I don't, there certainly isn't a question of grand corruption here.
But does FICAC have maybe somewhat a credibility problem because of this?
I think FICAC is an enormous problem, yes. I mean, the truth is FICAC was invented as a tool of the Bainimarama government to chase down its enemies. It was almost entirely targeting enemies of that government. And I think during those years, a kind of institutional culture emerged that has continued into the post-Bainimarama years. And some politicians perhaps made it convenient to use FICAC as a tool for their own purposes. Fiji badly needs a decent anti-corruption commission, but this is not it. And I think the country would be better off either disband it. Well, they can't disband it because it's in the constitution, but they could defund it or they could roll it into the police and at some point develop a new anti-corruption commission that could do the job that it really is intended to do rather than being an agency for political victimization.
Mr. Frankel, I mean, how much does all of this actually influence, you know, the national elections next year? Because if Mr. Prasad and Mr. Kamikamida were to be found guilty, I mean, you've got two popular leaders who are pretty much out of the race, right?
Well, I certainly don't think that even if those charges stuck, they would not be. I mean, there's no way they're going to be convicted for 2 years in prison, which would bar them from standing. So I don't think that's the critical issue. And I think the credibility issues are more important, because for many in the public, that they maybe won't distinguish between grand corruption and very petty offences. But I personally don't think this will make a dog's difference to how people vote next year, because those people who are energized by this commission of inquiry and like the attacks that are being made on these particular ministers, who are two of the most competent ministers in the government, by the way, those people weren't going to vote for the People's Alliance or the National Federation Party anyway. They are the former voters for Bainimarama who might go to the Fiji Labour Party. And I think the most indigenous Fijians will continue to back the People's Alliance Party. And I really don't think their vote will be influenced by this commission of inquiry or by these allegations. I do think, however, that there's more to play out in this dispute, because many senior politicians are acting as if it's business as usual, as if they can just carry on as they have been carrying on. But they may change their mind in the run-up to the next general elections, when you have to look to other politicians for some political solidarity. You have to decide on your coalitions. The other thing that they'll be fearing is the political wilderness. When you have breakaway parties, for example, often they just completely flop and get absolutely nowhere. So that's a danger that has to be avoided.
Yeah. And I suppose sort of moves, what do you think are going to be the next moves from government around the situation?
Well, I think Rambuka has indicated that he's worried about the repercussions of the Commission of Inquiry report. He's indicated that he is thinking of some changes as regards FICAC and rolling it into the police force, he said a couple of days ago, to abolish FICAC would require a constitutional amendment. I think a constitutional amendment is unlikely this side of a general election. We are only a year or so out at most. I think the election has to be held by February 2027. So we're more likely looking at constitutional changes after that election, and FICAC might be part of that. But certainly it's possible to revise the funding for FICAC before that. It's possible to reconfigure FICAC into the police force, and that seems to be what the Prime Minister is intending.
Well, as always, Mr. Frankel, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing our insights into the situation. So thank you very much for joining us this morning. No worries. That is political commentator John Frankel, Professor of Political Science at Victoria University in New Zealand, joining us here on Pacific Beat. Well, if you've just joined us, this is Pacific Beat, and I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Giving you just a quick recap of what's been on the show already, we spoke about PNG conjoined twin babies who are still in need of surgery. Also, Solomon Islands Prime Minister is spearheading a program to deal with the unexploded ordinances left behind from World War II. There's controversy over two cabinet ministers resigning within the space of 3 weeks in Fiji. And still to come, hotel staff, a bus ends up in Nandi River, highlights really the unsafe transport conditions for hospitality workers in Fiji. And of course, excitement is brewing as Tor Samoa preps for the finals clash against the Kiwis this weekend. All those stories shortly right here on Pacific Beat.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nisan Bulivinaka, while we head back to Fiji, where its Tourism Workers Union has sounded the alarm over unsafe transport conditions being endured by hotel staff travelling to and from work. It follows an accident on Monday morning which saw 43 people hospitalised after a hotel staff bus veered off a bridge and landed upside down in a river in Nandi. The union has since revealed that vehicles provided by hotels to transport employees are often poorly maintained, overcrowded, and in some cases, just not even roadworthy. To find out more, we're joined by Union Employee Relations Consultant Sailesh Nandu. With that, I say, Yandira Sailesh, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yeah, and then good morning from Fiji, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I must say, I have to ask, what was your actual reaction to the accident on Monday? I mean, and are you aware of how those people who were involved doing?
We were not surprised with this. Generally, we are aware of the conditions of workers, not only in the tourism industry, but in the other industries, of how they are treated. In respect of providing transportation to, you know, large-scale workplaces such as hotels.
What kinds of transport conditions are workers actually being exposed to?
See, in the various modes of transportation for workers in the bus industry, in the tourism industry, see, one of the forms are the buses. Then we have the minivans, and then you have there's some places where they load people into trucks and take you to the workplaces. Now, in Fiji, like the hotels are in different areas. You have some who are very close to the town and city centers, and there's some in very remote areas. So the transportation, mode of transportation, whether it's a bus or a minibus or a truck, is determined by the locations.
Well, Sailesh, because of some of those transport conditions, did Monday's bus accident actually highlight any of the concerns that you guys have?
Yes. We have been having reports from the hotels which we have been dealing with in other areas of Fiji. For example, if you're taken into a truck, if it's a rainy season, the truck would have a canopy and then you're loaded in, taken to the workplace. If it's a rainy season, you get up in the early in the morning, you are in the hospitality industry, supposed to look good, presentable. And if it's rain, so you get wet on the way. And you know, it's not comfortable traveling. At times, we also see where you have breakdowns. From places. We used to deal with one of the poultry companies, and this was highlighted in the newspaper. The people were transported in the same truck which used to have fertilizer and dead chicken on board. So these are the concerns we have been raising for a while in the system, and it seems that the employers are unable to take heed of it.
Well, and that's my next question, though, Sailesh. How long have workers held concerns over transport safety?
Transport is one of the benefits in this particular industry, tourism, they have to provide, because the timing and the shifts are quite different. And the locations of the hotels are on difficult routes where buses are not almost available. So unions have always been raising concern about transportation. Concern in the sense that, one, we want you to provide transportation because you need workers in that place, and transport is not there. So we have been raising transportation as a particular benefit which should benefit the worker, and this benefit should not be coming out of the earnings of the worker.
Well then, so why do you think conditions are so bad? I mean, do the hotels not allocate enough funding to transport? I mean, if so, why do you think that is?
See, look, there's a three-tiered approach in this, right? I mean, as unions, we just don't want to play the blame game, right? One is the bus service provider. The other is the employees, which is the hotels or any other employer who provides transportation to the worker. Then we have the compliance agency, regulatory agencies such as Land Transport Authority. See, in Fiji recently we have seen a great shortage of workers in all different fields of life. People have been going out of the country to work in other industries, in Australia, New Zealand, and other countries. And you would know that there are a large number of people who are working in our farm scheme also. Now, so we have seen new sets of people coming into the workplace, and bus industry is no exception. There has been shortage of bus drivers in the system. We have seen people elevating themselves from driving taxi to bus drivers, taking driving license. But I think one of the issues which is of concern is the level of experience, the level of training which is provided to the this industry workers, particularly the bus industry. Bus industry is also a very important industry in the country because a large segment of the community travels in buses from rural areas to the town and city centers to work. So we have seen gaps in this particular industry about service delivery, right? And as I said, that we just don't want to blame people to say, okay, drivers are bad or so on. But I think the regulatory authority has a very important role to play. Currently, we have the Land Transport Authority, which regulates all transportation systems in the country. I mean, what we have noticed is that they are basically doing compliance. You will see them doing compliance with the vehicles at the stations, or you'll see they're having roadblocks on the road, checking vehicles, issuing out tickets. In my view, they have a more important role to create awareness in the system, to go to these particular service providers who are very important, who deal with lives, because there are hundreds and thousands of people who travel in the buses, and they should be doing outreach programs with these companies. And my information is, because I also am engaged with the transport workers in Fiji, so my information from the bus drivers are that these people don't come. Before they used to come, about 5-6 years ago, they don't come and do awareness and training within the system as far as behavioral issues is concerned. We have to accept the fact that there is a gap in the industry. We don't have people. So when new people come in, the industry needs to subsidize the training of these people as to how their behavioral attitude is in the market.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Look, if you've just joined the program, I'm speaking to Union Employee Relations Consultant Sailesh Nandu about the recent accident of hotel staff in Fiji and how this has actually highlighted an already growing problem. So Sailesh, I believe the union, they've actually received reports, right, that in several hotels, employees are being made to actually pay for transport provided by the employer. Is that a breach of the Employment Act or not?
Yes, I can name it. I will not name the hotel, but I know about two hotels which is on our fold. There may be others too. And now after this awareness, there will be more coming in. They provide transport to the staff to come to work and go back to home, and they charge them. They charge them a fee. And at the end of the week, that amount is deducted from the pay, and that is a breach of any employment law, I would say, because when you are an employer and if you provide work to a person, the only thing you are supposed to do is you are supposed to pay them. You can't impose deductions as a condition of work. On the worker, right? So there are some statutory deductions which is by law, such as the provident fund or the tax, right? And there are certain deductions allowed under the law, such as the worker will give authority and you deduct union fees and you deduct credit union fees, yeah? Or you're making some kind of payment, but that is by consent. And there are also rules and regulations to it. It is controlled that you can't do. No? But these kind of deductions, such as transportation, that is a duty of care. You provide to the worker, and you can't charge. So we have seen, and we are attending to it. In one case, we are now we are at the mediation unit where we have raised this concern. So we're dealing with it. And we hope with this awareness, and any action like this creates some kind of awareness. And we are hopeful that we will be able to raise this awareness within the industry, say, look, you can't do that. You can't do that. And those people who are affected are lower paid workers.
Well, I'd like to know, if you know, Silas, how many workers really are relying on hotel transport to travel to and from work?
See, Fiji's economy heavily reliant on the tourism industry. There is a very large workforce who are engaged in the tourism industry, and not only to the hotels, but the other other industries which are dependent on the tourism industry. And the other, so there's a large segment of the community. The other aspect which I have raised earlier is that, see, the large segment of the people come from the lower paid sector. For example, housekeeping staff, people who work in the chefs, people who work in the bar, they are in Fiji paid the minimum wage between $5 to $6 or $6.50 in a load of hotels. So for them to expect that they are going to catch a taxi or a cab or something and come to those remote areas. If you look at Denarau, like it's outside Nandi. It is outside Nandi. So anybody who probably lives in Lautoka or in the highways in Nandi, they will have to come to Nandi town and then catch another bus to come to Denarau. That is in working hours, right? So that would be a bit of an extra cost for them, considering that they are lower paid workers. So we appreciate the fact that hotel industries have been providing transportation. That's good. We have raised some concern. All of them are not charging them. But coming back to your question, yes, there is a large segment of workforce who is dependent on this kind of transportation because they can't afford to bring their own transports or hire transport.
Well, I know you brought up the Ministry of Employment and Land Transport Authority earlier. The union has actually called for them to actually step in. So really, what kind of changes would you like to see being made?
See, making compliance laws is one part of it, right? Running after compliance is one part. We do it every day, right? But that does not necessarily resolve all the issues. This is a service sector. Tourism industry is a service sector, very important to the country. And as I said, there is shortage of workers, not only in the bus industry, but in fact in the tourism industry also. So compliance units such as Land Transport Authority need to be more proactive in the sense that you just don't go and issue tickets when there is a non-compliance. I think there has to be more awareness within the people who are engaged in providing transportation, the transport companies, the bus companies, assist them, organize them. They have the defensive driving test, I know. You do it once and it is valid for what, 5 or 6 years. You don't go back to them. I think there has to be regular updates. They have to plan out proper training and awareness going back because I think it's a living exercise. Things change every day. The challenges are changing. So I think they need to be more engaged with the industry to make sure that people are made aware of what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do.
Well, Silas, as we wrap up, do you really believe the union have adequate power to bring about change?
Yes, we have been quite active. I think after the last election, 2022, we have been very active. Today, we are thankful to ABC that you allowed us to talk about this issue. And I think this represents the work we do. The whole world will know, and people who are supposed to take action would probably listen to this program and bring about positive changes.
I do want to quickly just ask, though, do you feel like your membership numbers are healthy, though, or do you think employers may discourage workers from joining unions?
That is a common challenge for the union movement. We like all organizations, unions also adapt to the changes in society. And with good faith and dialogue and discussions, I think we will be able to manage it. We have some bad apples on the down the road, but I think we can still manage it.
Nice. Well, look, Mr. Silesh, look, we really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing about, of course, the union there in Fiji and what's been happening since, of course, this incident. So, again, thank you for your time. Vinaka.
Thank you, Vinaka.
That was Union Employee Relations Consultant Silesh Naidu here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois. We head to sport now and, well, from a parade and flashcards to mega fans meeting their idols. Tor Samoa's Pacific Championships campaign has reached its final leg in Sydney as they prepare to take on the Kiwis on Sunday afternoon. As the team gear up for the final, an estimated 2,000 fans turned out to show their support in true Samoan fashion at the Sydney Dragway in Western Sydney. Here's some of the sounds featuring Tor Samoa's Brian To'o and Terrell May.
Yeah, it's definitely special. You know, it's always been a pleasure to put on the Samoan jersey, but I think it makes it 10 times more special to have our beautiful people to come and support us through the good times and bad, so you're very blessed.
Nah, it's awesome, eh? I'm obviously a local here, so I'm a Western Sydney boy, and it's crazy the turnout we got for the boys out west, but yeah, a lot of love for the people out here, man.
Yeah, this is my home, born and bred in Mount Druitt, so these are my people and this is my blood, so yeah, very blessed to be a part of this this community.
I feel good, eh? I feel relaxed, recovered, and hopefully we can get the win on Sunday.
Well, our man Sini Iasuna was also in the crowd for the fans meet and greet, and he joins us now. Good morning, Sini, how you doing?
Talofa, Eggy, I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I mean, goodness, let's talk all things Tor Samoa. I mean, it sounded like people were pretty pumped there in what is Australia's largest Pacifica community. I mean, what was the atmosphere like? Like, how are the Tor Samoa players feeling?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I think the guys are excited to be in their homeland. Like, Sydney, for a lot of them, is their home. But I do need to set the record straight because I don't want Samoans coming for me. I actually grossly underestimated 685 last night. I estimated that 2,000 hardcore fans turned out to a Samoans fan day. But late last night, organisers actually estimate that 17,000 17,000 turned up.
Wow.
Which is just incredible. And I think we can trust their numbers more than mine because it was a ticketed event. So, yeah, I think their estimates would be far closer to mine. And, you know, 17,000 is huge and is probably a bit of a teaser of what's to come at this weekend's final game on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, again, how was the crowd? Like you said, 17,000. That definitely is an indication of what's going to happen this weekend. But sort of how did the fan event unfold? Like, I hear there were flash cars. What was this all about?
So, as you said, it was hosted at the Sydney Dragway, which was just packed of cars, as you can imagine, with Samoan flags, some really yummy food trucks, all the best island music, and yeah, packed with 17,000 fans, which just blows my mind. But it did, yeah, start with the Tor Samoa doing kind of a parade of their own in these like really bougie looking cars. I couldn't name what they were. I don't really have a clue on cars, but they looked flash, and yeah, all the boys were just spread out in these cars, heads out the kind of sunroofs. So that's kind of how it started. And as you can imagine, the fans were just going crazy for that. And then it kind of just moved into the boys being introduced up on stage, and then like a bit of a Q&A on how they're feeling ahead of the final. And it sounds like they're feeling prepared and relaxed about the final on Sunday. They've just had the week to kind of rest and relax and catch up with some family. But yeah, it sounds like they're as prepared as they can be ahead of their clash with the Kiwis.
Sini, do you know, or what did the fans have to say, you know, about what Sunday's match means to them?
Yeah, I think they're really excited about it being held in Sydney. Like you said, Sydney being the home of Australia's largest Pacifica community. So, yeah, they're really excited to see their national team play in Sydney. And for a lot of these fans out in Western Sydney, much of or many of the boys that play in Tour Samoa are from Western Sydney as well. So being able to see these guys that they've been able to follow throughout their careers play in such a big match for the Pacific Cup. I think they're really excited just to get amongst it. And like last night's kind of just the beginning for Sydney's fans. Throughout the week, there's going to be parades throughout Sydney. And then I think there will be a massive one on Sunday, kind of parading from one location right to the stadium before kickoff. So
of course,
of course.
I'm wondering though, but I don't know if you've spoken to anyone, but do you think fans think that this Samoan team is possibly better than the one that lost Australia, you know, in the World Cup back in 2022?
That's not a question we've asked the fans. I don't know if I'm brave enough to ask that. But definitely someone will a question that we'll have to ask.
Yeah. Well, look, Tour Samoa, right? They have to get through New Zealand first, because you know New Zealand really showed Tongans last weekend what they're made of. But Sydney, if we can dare to dream, like, what do you think the reaction will be like if Tour Samoa wins the final? Because really, this would be Samoa's first ever rugby league trophy, right, if they win?
Yeah, that's right. Well, if yesterday is anything to go by and they haven't even won yet, I think the scenes, not only just in Sydney, but in Samoa as well, will be something like we've never seen before. As the team have campaigned throughout their Pacific, throughout the Pacific Championships, we've seen parades in Brisbane or fan days even in Brisbane, Sydney, New Zealand, Samoa. And that's not often even just with the win. That's just with the with the team being in that country and in that city and playing. And yeah, like I said, the parades on the homeland have been really great to see in Samoa, but I'm actually not sure what the future of those are. Samoa Observer are reporting that the country's acting police commissioner has ruled out issuing parade permits altogether, and has told fans to find an alternative way to support their national team. He's kind of put that down to prioritising safety and obeying the law.
Sure.
So I guess for the people in Samoa, they might have to get creative.
And you know we are.
In celebrating Samoa's win.
And you know we will always find a way.
They'll find a way.
Yeah. Sydney, I mean, I just have to make sure. Are you actually going to be at the game?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So myself and Penina and Dinah, two of my colleagues at ABC Pacific, will be at the game before the boys, before Tour Samoa and the Kiwis, though. The Cook Islands will play South Africa, and that's a qualifier for the World Cup. So we'll be at that as well. But for those kinds of key games, we'll be there and be providing updates and all the best bits from the fans and the players throughout the day on ABC specific.
I'm not jealous
socials.
At all, Sandy. I'm not jealous at all. But I do have to ask, since you're going to be there, you have to give us a prediction on the score. What do you think it's going to be?
Oh, Aggie, I don't know if I even have the knowledge to to guess. The Kiwis were against Tonga. That was 40-14.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I hope that Tour Samoa can do better than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you have any,
I don't know, six,
any crystal
six, seven, no. I don't know. Look, again, I'm just hoping that Tour Samoa beats the Kiwis as much as I love my homeland. But I'm definitely going for Tour Samoa.
Yeah, me too. I mean, just being at yesterday's fan day, I'm proud to be Samoan, and I'm not even Samoan. So I'm looking forward to being in and amongst it throughout the week and at the fan day. And even despite Tonga's brutal loss over the weekend, there were even some brave Tongans at Tour Samoa's fan day yesterday, flying the Tongan flag high.
Oh, look, we were still all always going to be in support of our Pacific players. But look, Seni, it's all the time we have for this morning. But look, enjoy the game. And yeah, we just appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Thank you so much, Iggy.
No worries. All day. That is ABC Pacific reporter Seni Iasona. Our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tō awha atu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.